we're going to read from Luke, which is page 1024 of the Bibles on your tables. We're just going to read the first four verses, so that's Luke 1, verse 1. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things to be fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seems good also for me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught.
So the Bible, out of date, unreliable, and biased. Three questions to take. Out of date. I suppose the implication is that something that is old isn't of much relevance for today. I hope to sort of show that it isn't. Unreliable. Well, you could take that in a number of ways. You could take it in terms of, is it reliable to base our whole lifestyle on? But I'm taking it to be reliability in terms of, do we have before us what the authors actually wrote? Because if we don't, then the rest is truly academic. And bias. Bias tends to be used on one extreme of the range to be somewhere where something has been so spun that we've lost track of the facts. When in fact, bias can simply mean that somebody is a passionate and persuasive advocate of something they mean to be, they believe to in fact be true, and you can verify it. So, out of date. I can see why people might think that the Bible is out of date. After all, you may well only have encountered an old translation with plenty of these and thous. If you manage to get past those, you may have encountered a culture which is largely agricultural. It's between 2,000 and 4,000 years old, and it's between 2,000 and 3,000 miles away. There's also quite a lot of weird stuff in the Bible. I mean, I'm breaking a commandment of the Old Testament by wearing mixed fibres. Why do they say that? That doesn't seem to be kind of terribly useful for today, does it? You might not like the sexual ethic of the Bible. It's not exactly PC today, is it? Or you may simply dismiss it as simply pre-scientific stuff. So I can see why you might think so. But consider, if it's a translation that's the problem, just get a modern one. There are plenty of those around which don't have ancient language in. If the cultural setting's a bit difficult, acquire a commentary which will help you understand the background of what is actually being written. If it's the weird stuff, well, the commentary would also help, because the whole point, for example, of the don't wear mixed fibres was to the people of God who were told, effectively as a visual aid, to say, don't get tangled up with those of your neighbours, because they went in for stuff like child sacrifice and human sacrifice and all sorts of horrible things, and God did not want his people tangled up with that, and that was a simple way of reminding them of it. Or take the sexual ethic. I mean, the last 50 years have been a real experiment, largely in our culture, but, you know, is 50 years worth of experience going to trump 5,000 years worth of experience when it's all had ups and downs and things have been tried out and have not? You know, where do you go? Where would you get the greatest source of wisdom, from a longer period of time or a shorter period of time? Or do you just dismiss it as pre-scientific stuff? Well, what do you make of the fact that some of the world's leading scientists, like him, his name's Daniel Hastings, he's professor at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which when I looked the other day is rated first in the world of universities. He's the dean. He's a professor of aeronautics, astronautics, and advanced engineering systems. He's on the board of the space agency NASA. He was chief scientific officer of the United States Air Force when he was 35. He's appointed by the president as only one of 20 on the board of science in America. His comment, "I have never found my occupation as a scientist and engineer to be in conflict with my faith." There isn't time to go into that, but when you have people like him who take that line, one thing I can be sure of, he's cleverer than anybody who's here. And if we're humble enough, we would realise, well, there might be some mileage. If you can properly understand the Bible, you'll discover it doesn't conflict with science. In fact, the Bible, one of the reasons why it may seem to, is because it uses, for example, the language of observation, which is the sun rises and the sun sets. Now, we say that, don't we? But we know that that isn't scientifically true, although I suspect very few of us could be able to explain why it isn't true. Or take what they call anthropomorphic language, where God is spoken of as the finger of God, but the Bible says God is spirit, he doesn't possess a body. But we all know it's that kind of language, don't we? So it's not something to actually necessarily be a barrier to accepting that the Bible has actually got something to say. But just because something is old doesn't mean that it's not true. I mean, think about it. What has changed over time? I mean, sure, we've come to understand the world in which we live a lot better. God has blessed us with people with good minds who've studied an ordered universe and have understood it better and have dreamt up a vocabulary to try and explain it to us. But although our understanding may have improved, human nature hasn't improved. We're just cleverer sinners than they may have been in the past. Human nature is still much the same. Take falling in love, for example. Has that changed much over the millennia? You know, don't people feel exactly the same today as they would have done with those emotions 100, 1,000, 200, 2,000 years ago? I mean, think of that euphoric sense that I noticed this week amongst some women with the news of an engagement. It reminded me of some words of Shakespeare. "Cupid is a knavish lad. He makes the females go mad." Or maybe if you want another bit from Shakespeare, who was a real astute observer of human nature. You know, think of the state that some people get into when they are in love. I think he said, "Love is blind and lovers cannot see the petty follies they themselves commit." Now, is that not as true today in some cases as it was 500 years ago? Does the fact that he spotted it 500 years ago mean that it's not of value today? Or if your love life's not going too well, I can identify with this quote of Ovid. Ovid lived at the same time as Jesus. He was a Roman poet. I can remember when I was, perhaps in my 20s, this might be true of you. Actually, it wasn't true of me, actually. But anyway, but it is true of a lot of people I know. "Those I chase flee from me, and those who chase me I flee from." That's worth repeating, isn't it, really? That is a sort of shrewd bit of advice, that. "Those I chase flee from me, and those who chase me I flee from." Well, you've only got to connect up with one person and it'll be all right. So an accurate observation of human life doesn't, just because it's made long ago, 500 years or 2,000 years ago, doesn't really impinge upon whether or not it's of value for today. And what's more, there are the big questions of life, aren't there? Questions like, why am I here? Is there a God? What happens when I die? How can I know what he's like? Why do I feel at a distance from him and apprehensive should I ever encounter him? I mean, such questions have been asked in every generation, and they continue to be asked today, wherever you happen to live in the world. Now, the answers to those questions that the Bible gives have the advantage of having stood the test of time. They've had at least 2,000, if not 4,000 years for some of them, of being kind of stress tested by people. And they have been found to stand up, because billions of people today not only have found them worth investigating, but they have embraced the wisdom that has its origin thousands of years ago. They may be dated, but they're not actually out of date. So unreliable. I suppose the problem there for many people are miracles, really, when they consider its reliability. They reason like this, perhaps you do, that you think to yourself, well, I've never seen a miracle, and miracles don't seem to happen now. And then you make the jump that since they don't happen today, they couldn't have happened at the time when they were recorded to have happened. You think to yourself, they've been made up. But think for a moment. Open your mind slightly. If there is a God, and if God were to appear on earth, if he's no different from us, we'd never spot him. Or even if he claimed to be, he hasn't done anything to demonstrate the fact that he is who he says he is. You know, he has to do some things which are pretty remarkable, one might say miraculous, in order for us to be able to identify him, and for those who saw him, to be pretty sure of who he is. So I would expect God to do some pretty supernatural, miraculous stuff if he were to pitch up in our world, wouldn't you? All I'm asking you to do is consider that that isn't an unreasonable thought. In other words, it opens your mind to the possibility, rather than having a closed mind, in which, of course, case you never discover anything new. But closed minds can be like closed parachutes, fatal. So we need to approach the Bible with an open mind. And let's just this evening consider the life of Jesus. Let's find out three things. How the accounts came to be composed, and we'll use Luke's account for that, because he's the one who tells us how he went about composing it. Then look at whether we have today the words that they wrote then, and then consider whether what's before us can in fact be verified, whether it can be checked out by other people who lived at the time who've got no particular axe to grind, that they're not Christians, for example, or whether there's bits of archaeological and literary sort of junk left around the ancient world which corroborate some of the things which are otherwise only in the Bible. So we start with Luke. We've had it read to us. And what Luke is trying to do is he's saying to us that he's carried out a process. He has interviewed eyewitnesses, he's gathered oral and written reports, and he's, you know, checked them out against each other. And these are the people who were closest to Jesus in his lifetime, and he begins to work out what he calls an orderly account. In other words, he's talked to the major players. He's talked to the people who lived with Jesus for 3 years, who heard him, who saw what he'd done. He may even have talked to those who still oppose Jesus. He certainly spoke to Jesus' mother, because some of the stuff he knows about the infancy of Jesus could only have come from her. And then he writes about the expansion of the church that he was involved in himself. And then he tells us that he's produced this two-volume work, which we call Luke Acts. And the interesting thing about it is that Acts stops around about 62 AD, or just 30 years after Jesus was around. So I'd like to ask, first of all, this question. Are the biblical manuscripts reliable? Do we have before us what Luke actually wrote? So are they reliable? Do we have before us what he actually wrote? And then we'll go on to look at whether, assuming that we do have what he wrote, whether the content of those manuscripts, where they can be checked out, stack up. They're not contradicted. So, the manuscripts. They're written, the New Testament, on papyri. Papyri is a highly durable reed that you find in the Nile Valley, and it's glued together rather like plywood is, and it's laid out to dry in the sun. And there have been many bits of papyri found, both biblical and non-biblical, and they are especially easy to discover in a dry land of North Africa and the Middle East. And the example that is there, you can find in Manchester. You'd find it in what's called the John Rylands Library in the University of Manchester. It contains part of John chapter 18, verses 31 to 33 and 36 to 37. And it is dated to around 120 AD, which is probably 40, 50 years, might even be less, after John actually wrote it. And you can see it today if you ever go to Manchester. Now, if we compare the New Testament with all the other sort of other bits, other similar ancient books that are around today, things which you may have heard of, if you've kind of read, if you've seen the film Troy, then you know you'd be familiar with Homer's writing. But there are other people like Plato, a great thinker, Julius Caesar, who was a Roman emperor and invaded East Kent a couple of times, but not for very long. And if you take their bits of, if you take Homer's writing, the Iliad, there are about 643 copies. The time between writing them and the earliest surviving manuscripts, about 500 years. If you take Caesar's Gallic Wars, there are 10 ancient copies. The oldest, the oldest one we have is 1,000 years after Caesar wrote. But if you take the New Testament and you take all the different translations, there are 24,000 copies, and they're written anything between 40 and 90. The oldest manuscripts are between 40 and 90 years after the original, because, of course, we don't have the originals of any of these writings at all. So notice there are many more copies of the New Testament in existence than Homer, than Plato, who's only got 7, Caesar's got 10. And of those manuscripts, they are much closer to the originals than any other ancient Near Eastern text that we might consider. Sir Frederick Kenyon was the former director of the British Museum, and in his book, The Bible and Archaeology, he says this about the New Testament. The interval, then, between the dates of original composition and the earliest extant evidence becomes so small as to be, in fact, negligible, and the last foundation for any doubt that the scriptures have come down to us substantially as they were written has now been removed. Both the authenticity and the general integrity of the books of the New Testament may be regarded as finally established. So in other words, to be sceptical about the 27 documents in the New Testament and to say that they're unreliable is to allow all of classical antiquity to slip into obscurity. For no documents, he says, of the ancient period are as well attested bibliographically as these in the New Testament. What's more, they come from a wide geographical area and a variety of languages. So 5,000 of them are in Greek, which is what they were written in, and the rest are translations. They are written in of Latin, Syriac, Coptic, Armenian, Ethiopic, etc. Now, it's inevitable when you have all that copying going on that there will be variations in all these thousands of manuscripts. There could be spelling errors, there could be sort of transposition of words. After all, there weren't any photocopiers in those days. They didn't have glasses to wear, for those of us whose kind of eyesight is impaired as we get older. There weren't any bright electric light. It's all done either in daylight or under candles. And it'd be quite easy for mistakes to be made. So how much do these manuscripts actually differ from one another? You see, because if the differences are too big, then they would greatly compound the difficulty of deciding which manuscripts are reliable copies of the originals and which are not, and what the original documents really said. But if the differences can be attributed to scribal errors, such as misspellings and kind of words in the wrong place, then it would be much easier to ascertain the contents of the original documents. Bruce Metzinger is an American. He's probably the world's authority on textual criticism. That's working out these things. He says this: the more often you have copies that agree with each other, especially if they emerge from different geographical areas, the more you can cross-check them to figure out what the original document was like. The only way they'd agree would be where they went back genealogically in a family tree that represents the descent of the manuscripts. He himself made a study comparing all of these manuscripts that were available, and he compared them to the Iliad by Homer, and he compared them to the Mahabharata, which is, in case you weren't familiar with it, is a Sanskrit document of about 250,000 lines, and it's from India. And all the variations which didn't affect the meaning of the lines, such as spellings and words in the wrong place, they were ignored. Only the variations which were significant were in fact taken into account. And this is what he ended up with. According to him, the Iliad, which is the one in the middle, that has almost a 5% distortion rate. That means 764 lines out of 15,600 lines were corrupted, and meant you couldn't be clear as to what actually the text said. Now that is probably the norm for that kind of literature from that kind of time. But it's very rarely kind of flagged up. Now, when you compare the New Testament, what do you find? Well, actually, compare the Sanskrit one, first of all, because that has loads and loads of lines which are corrupted, perhaps just over 10%. It means that one in every 10 lines is really up for grabs. You can't be sure what it means in that Sanskrit document. But think of the New Testament. What we have here is quite incredible. We have only 40 lines out of 20,000 lines in the New Testament. That is a fifth of 1%. That is 0.2% are distorted. And of those, none of them are in fact significant. So compared to any other document, whether it's the Middle East or whether it's the Indian subcontinent, from that particular period, the New Testament documents are so much more likely that we have what these guys originally wrote. F.F. Bruce was a professor of biblical studies at Manchester University. He says, the variant readings about which any doubt remain among textual critics of the New Testament affect no material question of historic fact or of Christian faith and practice. Well, you may wonder how, in fact, if they do, when they sort of put all these manuscripts together and they spot something that isn't, that is different, how do they go about working out what is the real thing? Well, I don't know if you can see, this is kind of the original, which we don't have any copies of. In the second century, they managed to copy it accurately. But then in the third century, somebody doing a copy managed to miss out the word only. So instead of the only Son of God that these four have, this one misses it out. And then in the next century, you find there's a couple of copies from that, but the others are being accurate. And then by the time you got into the fifth century, you've got quite a lot of things which have actually all gone haywire. So the way they work it out is they're dealing there with 26 different manuscripts, and they create this family tree because they can work out from where it's found, kind of the age of the ink and all that sort of stuff. They can work out sort of this tree of which century it was actually written in, and they place it all out like this, and so they can trace what they call daughter to father manuscripts. And working back from the 5th century, they can see where something has gone wrong, and they can be fairly certain what is the correct text. So if you had it in a sort of summary form, you take the New Testament, you've got 0.2% of the lines have got a question mark against them. We can't be absolutely certain whether it should be this letter or that letter. There are 5,000 copies of just the Greek, there are another 20,000 copies of other ancient manuscripts which contain bits of the New Testament. That these copies originated from perhaps 30 or 40 years or so after, in bits, but in terms of whole books of the Bible, you're talking 100, maybe 150 years afterwards. But you compare that to one of the best examples of ancient literature, Homer's Iliad, and there 5% of the lines are up for kind of questioning. And there are only 643 copies, well, considerably more than Julius Caesar and Plato, but they're from 500 years or so afterwards. So which do you think is most likely to be containing the original? Do you not think there's quite... Well, you've got to write off all of ancient literature if you don't think the New Testament enables us, you know, we have before us what those guys wrote. And that's some big write-off if you go for that kind of line of argument. So what we have is more copies from a wider geographical area, closer in time to the originals, and considerably fewer distorted lines. So I think what we do have is what those authors actually wrote. The next question about being biased gives us this, because bias is usually used that somebody gets so kind of keen on what that is that they're writing that they distort the facts. But I'd like to suggest that somebody can be passionate and persuasive about something and wanting to persuade you that it's true without distorting the facts. And how can you do that? Well, you can do it by trying to check out where it is checkable, to verify where it's verifiable. And that's what we do here with just taking Luke. Now, just to give you what I'm doing here, you won't be able to find quite a lot of stuff. It isn't capable of being checked or verified. But often the smaller background details are. So if somebody was telling me about somebody of my age telling me about their grandfather in the First World War and was telling me that, they've got letters from him to his family telling them how he was drinking Budweiser, I'd know they were telling Porky Pies, because Budweiser as a drink is not that old. It's American anyway. Now, if they were drinking Fremlin's Elephant Ale, as my granddad, who did fight in the First World War, drank, I'd suspect there could be some truth in the rest of what I couldn't check. So it's looking at the sort of incidentals, it's looking at the background details that give us some idea as to whether, where we can check them, they turn out to be true. So take this guy's name, Lysanias. Many people used to think that the Bible had numerous historical errors. And this one is about Lysanias being the tetrarch of Abilene in about 27 AD, as Luke claims in chapter 3, verse 1. For many years, scholars used this, they thought this was a factual error to prove that Luke was wrong, because it was common knowledge that Lysanias was not a tetrarch, but the ruler of Chalcis about 50 years earlier than what Luke described. So they thought, well, he's wrong on that. He's probably wrong on the rest of the stuff. But then an archaeological inscription was found that said Lysanias was in fact the tetrarch of Abila near Damascus at the time that Luke said he was. You see, it turns out that, of course, there are two Lysanias who live in different places at different times and do different things, unsurprisingly. Or take Pontius Pilate. There's an inscription in Caesarea Maritima, which is on the Israeli coast, where Pontius Pilate is named prefect or governor of Judea, which is exactly what Luke in chapter 3 says. Now, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, when Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea. Or take Gallio in Acts 18, verse 12. A decree of Claudius was found at Delphi in Greece, which describes Gallio as proconsul of Achaia in AD 51, which gives a correlation with the ministry of Paul in Corinth in Acts 18, 12, where it says, "But while Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews with one accord rose up against Paul and brought him before the judgment seat." Or take Erastus, mentioned in Romans 16, 23. Excavations reveal a text naming a benefactor called Erastus, which may be a reference to the city treasurer of Romans 16, 23, where we read, "Gaius, host to me and to the whole church, greets you. Erastus, the city treasurer, greets you, and Quartus, the brother." Or if you go to Ephesus in western Turkey, parts of the temple of Artemis have been uncovered, and that temple is mentioned a couple of times in Acts 19, where they say, "And when they heard this and were filled with rage, they began crying out, saying, Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." Or Quirinius. It's known that Quirinius was made governor of Syria by Augustus in AD 6. Sir William Ramsay discovered several inscriptions which indicated that Quirinius was governor of Syria on two occasions, the first time several years prior to that date. Or take Polyarchs and Asiarchs, maybe not the most exciting thing to think about, but again, Luke's historical trustworthiness is attested by a number of inscriptions. The Polytarchs of Thessalonica, Acts 17, were magistrates and are named in five inscriptions from the city in the first century. Significantly, the same posts in Turkey were called Asiarchs. Now, it's easy to get those mixed up if, of course, you didn't actually go there and encounter these guys face to face, as Luke did. Or Publius is correctly designated Protos, or first man, in Acts 28, 7. So there are many archaeological verifications of kind of biblical titles, biblical places, biblical beliefs that you can check from some of the archaeology that's been discovered to date. And what it just simply means is that if they get the background details right where you can check them, then that's much more likely that they got the details which you can't check right, doesn't it? If they consistently got these things wrong, you would quite rightly doubt what they wrote that you couldn't check. Some people think, was the New Testament written hundreds of years after Christ? But when you read the New Testament, one really big significant event is just after the New Testament period is the destruction of the Temple of Jerusalem. The Jews had revolted against the Romans. The Romans brutally put down the revolt and they destroyed the temple. But in all the Gospels, they don't mention. It's mentioned that the temple will be destroyed, but there's never kind of editorial footnote which says this happened. The reason? Because it hadn't happened when they wrote their Gospels. So their Gospels must be written before 70 AD. It's interesting also that in the Acts of the Apostles, Luke doesn't mention, for example, the death of James in 62 AD, of Paul in 64, or Peter in 65. Why? Because I don't suppose they had happened when he wrote Acts. So if he was writing Acts at about 62 AD, then he wrote his Gospel at least a few months, if not a year or so, beforehand. So this is quite close. This is within 30 years of Jesus actually living. So I don't think it was written, hundreds of years afterwards at all. Well, there are numerous other bods who who, like Sir William Ramsay, who started out incredibly sceptical about the historical veracity of the New Testament. But he concluded, having travelled around the region and investigating things, he says, the present writer takes the view that Luke's history is unsurpassed in respect of its trustworthiness. And he lists even more than I've done of occasions and incidents which kind of back this up. Little things like, was Sergius Paulus a proconsul? Well, yes, though 68 years earlier, the same position would have been occupied by a propraetor. Again, another kind of terribly little insignificant detail, but one which Luke time and time again manages to get right. So let's try thinking of some other people who weren't Christians, except possibly Josephus here, that these are people who lived within 100 years, mostly, of New Testament times, who are not Christians, but who do actually make comments about things which show that Christianity was actually in existence and operating. Pliny the Younger, he saw and recorded the eruption of Vesuvius in 79 AD, but he later became the Roman governor of northern Turkey. And when he, in 112 AD, he wrote to Emperor Trajan concerning how to deal with Christians who refused to worship the emperor and instead worship somebody called Christus, which is, of course, the Latin version of Christ. This is what Pliny the Younger wrote to his emperor. In the case of those who were denounced to me as Christians, I have observed the following procedure. I interrogated these as to whether they were Christians. Those who confessed, I interrogated a second and a third time, threatening them with punishment. Those who persisted, I ordered executed. For I had no doubt that whatever the nature of their creed, stubbornness and inflexible obstinacy surely deserved to be punished. There were others possessed of the same folly, but because they were Roman citizens, I signed an order for them to be transferred to Rome. Which, of course, is what happened to Paul, who was a Roman citizen sort of 50 years before. He also writes about the Christians. He says, they, the Christians, were in the habit of meeting on a certain fixed day before it was light, when they sang in alternate verses a hymn to Christ as to a God, and bound themselves by a solemn oath, not to any wicked deeds, but never to commit any fraud, theft, or adultery, never to falsify their word, nor deny a trust when they should be called upon to deliver it up, after which it was their custom to separate and then reassemble to partake of food, but food of an ordinary and innocent kind. And there's this guy Tacitus. He wrote this, Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. He also wrote that Nero fastened the guilt of starting the blaze and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. And the most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their centre and become popular. Or Suetonius. He wrote the Lives of 12 Caesars. He mentions the riot which broke out in 49 AD, which was actually between Christians and Jews. He says, and the Jews were making constant disturbances at the instigation of Crestus. So so Claudius expelled them, that's the Jews, from Rome. That's noted in Acts 18, verse 2. Or Josephus. He wrote, he was a Jew and a Roman citizen, and he worked for the Romans, and he wrote Antiquities, and he mentions, now there was at this time a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as receive the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men among us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him. For he appeared to them alive again the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold, these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. And the tribe of Christians, so named after him, are not extinct to this day. There's this guy Thallus, who was writing around about 100 AD. His work is recorded by other people, and he mentions, apparently, concerning somebody, his work is recorded by another person called Julius Africanus. But what Thallus had written was, on the whole world there pressed a most fearful darkness, and the rocks were rent by an earthquake, and many places in Judea and other districts were thrown down. This darkness, Thallus, in his third book of history, calls, as appears to me without reason, Africanus says, an eclipse of the sun. He's writing about what happened in 30 AD, the time of Jesus's crucifixion. Or this guy, Lucian, who is a Romano-Syrian satirist, who wrote in Greek. He talks about the Christians, you know, worship a man to this day, the distinguished personage who introduced their novel rites and was crucified on that account. So I think I'd like to conclude that what the original authors wrote is what we have. And where the text is checkable, it corroborates. There isn't an example where it doesn't. So we can have confidence not only that we have what they wrote, but that where it can be checked, what they wrote is accurate. To quote the former keeper of the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, no archaeological discovery has ever contradicted the Bible. So I think we can have every confidence in what we have before us. So here's some questions which you might like to talk about around your tables for a while. Nick will tell you how we're going to do it, but here are some questions. Does merely being old make a document irrelevant? Can you think of any part of the Bible that is inaccurate? Biased if it distorts the facts is wrong, yes or no? That's fairly obvious. But biased if passionate, persuasive is good, yes or no? And if any other questions arise in discussion, make a note of them and we'll address them later. So out of date, unreliable, biased. Well, I don't think so.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention? I'm going to let Clive start a couple of questions, and while he answers those, I'm going to come around, and if you've got any written down, give them to me, please.
And there's one question, which is, what evidence is there for other religious texts, such as the Quran? The thing I think about that's worth saying about the Quran is, you know, Muhammad lived in the sort of the 400s or so AD, which is 400 years after Jesus. And in the Quran, he says that Jesus didn't die on the cross. Somebody took his place. So what I'd want to say to you, it's a bit like somebody today saying that Henry VIII had 7 wives. Nobody in the previous 500 years has ever said Henry VIII had 7 wives. There is no evidence for it whatsoever. Similarly, nobody said that Jesus didn't die on the cross. And it pops up 400 years later. Who do you think is likely to have got it right? You know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, or Muhammad? The way I put the question means that, you know, there's a fairly obvious answer. The other one is, what evidence is there for Old Testament texts? Well, that would take even longer, because there's obviously it's a longer thing. But just take the book of Isaiah. Until 1947, The oldest copy of the book of Isaiah that we had was dated around about 1000 AD. But in 1947, as you probably know, a shepherd boy was throwing stones and one went ping and broke a jar. And in the caves in Qumran on the northwest shores of the Dead Sea, they discovered lots of texts which had been written by the Essene community who lived there around about 200 to 100 BC, before Christ. And they wrote copies of the Old Testament and other literature, and they stored it on parchment and papyri, which they put in these kind of jars with a lid on. And there was a copy, a complete copy of the whole of the book of Isaiah. So they were able to compare a copy of Isaiah written 125 BC with one written 1,000 years AD. And there are hardly any differences. If you take one particular chapter, Isaiah 53, I've got it on my laptop somewhere, but from memory, by the time you go through the sort of 17 points of difference, i.e. 17 letters, you're left with three, which they can't quite be certain of, and doesn't make any difference anyway. So that's quite an impressive example of how the copyists, you know, because of course they thought they were writing down, copying down the words of God, that they were in fact very accurate indeed in their copying. You ask the question.
Okay.
And then give it to me.
Okay, so some of the questions kind of group together in groups, so I'll ask a couple that are quite similar. And so this is a question about the canon. So so I'll ask the question so you know what the canon means. It means why were the particular books of the Bible chosen? Could there be other writings that could have put things in a different perspective? And there's a question linked to that, is why is the Apocrypha not in the New Testament?
Uh-huh. Well, I don't know if you've... Well, There's a difference between the Apocrypha, which is the stuff that's between the Old and the New Testament, which largely covers that period from 400 BC to around about the time of Jesus, and talks about when the Greeks were in charge and certain kind of historic events. And there's nothing, you know, there's nothing particularly in them that is of, it wouldn't be recognized as divine revelation, because that stops with Malachi and starts again with John the Baptist. But it's interesting historical background for that 400-year period. If you read it, you wouldn't find it of the same kind of literature. The closest thing it's like is perhaps the Book of Kings, minus any miraculous events. If the other question about how did they choose the canon? That's where you have a thing called pseudepigrapha. Pseudo means false, and epigrapha is writing, so they're false writings. So there's a lot of stuff written by Gnostics who wrote after 100 AD, and there are things like the Gospel of Thomas and various other stuff. But again, if you read it, you know, they have sort of silly miracles like sardines jumping out of a jar and dying and then being resurrected or something, and that kind of stuff. When you read it, it's just nonsense. It's a totally different stuff altogether. So what around in the 300s, when they kind of finally drew the canon together, although, of course, much of it had been decided really before, they were just kind of regularizing it, was that if something had been written by an apostle, or that the person who wrote it had an apostle as their primary source, so Mark, for example, has Peter as his primary source, so we're told by one of the people writing around about 100 AD, or Luke tells us that he got his information firsthand from all of the apostles and Mary and other people. If it was an apostle, or if it was an apostle behind the information, then they recognized it as being writings from God, because the apostles also had the ability to do miraculous signs and wonders. It was God's way, we're told, of attesting that what they said was true. And again, I just invite you to read the alternatives which weren't included, and, you know, they are not of the same kind of... date or calibre, really.
Just another question about the composition of the Bible at the end of Mark's Gospel.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so, I don't think that's an example where, as they say, the earliest manuscripts and some other ancient witnesses do not have Mark 16, 9 to 20. That's also true of a part of John 8. And that's true. Somehow or other, they got kind of added in by somebody somewhere along the line, but the oldest manuscripts don't have them. The question with Mark, you have to think, is, well, did it end at Mark 16, verse 8? Or was there a missing ending? But again, what's included in Mark 9 to 20? There isn't really much that's in there that isn't elsewhere in the Bible. But they're the two principal passages, Mark 16 and John 8. And yeah, somehow for the King James Version that we have, which was 1611, that they were included in, whereas we have discovered more manuscripts since then and realised they shouldn't have been.
Just very quickly, what does Jehovah's Witnesses base the Bible on?
I don't know anything much about Jehovah's Witnesses, except that...
What's the question?
What do Jehovah's Witnesses base the Bible on? I mean...
As far as I understand it, they have the same Greek New Testament, but they have their own translation.
They do, yeah, they do, and their text isn't they miss out things like the definite article when it's referred to the word, so they would then argue that Jesus isn't divine. But
okay, if God performed miracles to show His power when He came to earth, why doesn't He today?
Right. Well, because. If you look at where miracles pop up in the Bible, they aren't there every 5 minutes. You might be suspicious if they were. But miracles basically occur at certain principal periods. They cluster around particular individuals. They cluster around Moses, you know, the 10 plagues of Egypt, for example. They cluster around Elijah and Elisha, who are the first of the prophets. They both raised an individual from the dead. There are a number of kind of one-off ones that you get, like Daniel had one happen to him, and Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, another one happened to them. And then you get Jesus, and then you get the apostles. And it says, Deuteronomy 34, verse 10 of Moses, you know, how he was unique, how God knew him face to face, and he did these wonderful things. And it says also of Jesus and the apostles that God was, in Hebrews, in Acts, and 2 Corinthians 12, 12 of the apostles, how God used the miracles to attest that they were His spokesman. Now, if He's kind of had His final word, you know, that basically after Jesus ascended, there is nothing else to happen until He returns, there's no revelation required in that intervening period, you won't get people who are apostles or prophets who have a word from God, and so they won't end up with a track record of doing miracles. When they say this will happen, there is no doubt about it happening, and it always happens. Now, that's not the same thing as saying that miracles don't necessarily happen today, just that if they do, they won't be associated with somebody who will keep repeating being able to do it, nor will they have any fresh revelation from God.
Thank you very much. Which gospel do you think is the most accurate?
Well, I mean, I think they're all accurate. Okay, I mean, as long as you drop out the last bit of Mark and the half of chapter 8 of John, I don't think it's a question of... you see, if you put Matthew, Mark and Luke... in parallel, and you compare one with the other, you'll find that there are slightly different words sometimes. But do you think Jesus spoke, for example, the parable of the sower only once? I don't suppose He did. And they will remember, you know, they will remember, or they'll have had passed to them, accounts from different times he said it. That's why you'll end up with little differences in if you compare exactly one with the other. They choose to leave certain bits out, or they choose to include certain bits because they're perhaps with a different audience in mind, because Luke is writing to Gentiles, Matthew is most likely writing to Jews.
So person also would like to know which is your favourite of the Gospels?
Oh, well, it's probably a choice between Mark and Luke, really. Mark keeps to the bare details, so I like that. But Luke is the one that I probably studied the most, and of course he's writing to me, a Gentile. I prefer those to kind of John, because I'm not really very into kind of literature, and as soon as you get onto sort of poetry and symbolism, I'm off, really. So,
okay.
I've not got much emotional intelligence, you see. So,
good.